When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I do love you. And you know, there is something very important that we need to do as soon as possible.
What's that?
Hi, everybody. I'm Dan.
And I'm Mike.
So welcome to a special episode of 15-Minute Film Fanatics. Now, you know the premise of the show is that Mike and I, two lifelong friends, watch movies separately and talk about them on the show for the first time. We never discuss what we think about the films, but generally we pick movies that we think we're both going to like. And that kind of like the fun of the show is, you know, I liked it for this reason, you liked it for that reason. Oh, did you notice this? No, I never thought about that. It's like trying to recreate a conversation in the diner after you've seen a great movie and you just want to talk to somebody. And I think Mike and I have invented this podcast because I just need somebody to talk to about movies, and so does Mike, and we're like, fine, let's make a podcast out of it. So usually we don't know what the other guy thinks, but today it's a special episode because what movie are we doing today, Mike?
Eyes Wide Shut.
We're doing Eyes Wide Shut, 1999, obviously the last film by Stanley Kubrick. I had watched this a couple of weeks ago, and I knew that Mike was not a fan. Mike famously said in a past episode, what did you say about Eyes Wide Shut?
I said that you were the smartest person to ever finish Eyes Wide Shut.
And I said, ha ha ha. But I just read a lot more about Kubrick. And I said, you know what? Let me go check this out again. I haven't seen it in a long time. I did. I thought it was terrific. I think Eyes Wide Shut's a terrific movie. Mike, I know, does not. I had to talk him off the ledge when he was watching it again. He almost bailed in the middle. I said, it's dishonest to the listeners, man. You cannot bail on the movie and then do an episode. So Mike did stick it out. He did stick it out. And that's what we're going to talk about now. So in part one, we always talk about our overall take on the movie. And I'm going to go first, Mike, if that's okay.
Go for it.
I think that this movie is a substantial work of art by a great artist. And I think the way to think about it is this. Kubrick was not great. That's wrong. Kubrick's forte was not domestic life. He was not like the John Cheever of the cinema or something. But I think that one of the reasons The Shining works so well is because it hits on something domestic, right? The real horror of The Shining is if you were put in that situation, would you become like Jack Torrance? Now, he's got a lot of baggage, as we know, before that movie even starts, right? But the domestic evil that lurks underneath the Torrance's family life is kind of metastasized by the hotel. That hotel works on Jack because it's playing with stuff that's already there. I think that what goes on in Eyes Wide Shut is this. The quote-unquote scary thing about it is you don't know the person to whom you are married. I think Tom Cruise is a doctor, he's a healer, and he doesn't know anything. The movie is Physician, Heal Thyself. Sidney Pollack tells him in the movie, you've been out of your depth for the last 24 hours, and he's correct. So I think that the movie, the quote-unquote scariness of the movie is that he really doesn't know what he's talking about. The movie hinges upon an argument he has with his wife, which, by the way, I'll just say that argument is a great one-act play. I think that scene is so perfect when they're smoking pot and arguing about her fantasy. And I think that he finds out that his smug self-assuredness really doesn't hold any water. She says to him in the beginning, he's trying to tell her how men think and how women think. And she says, well, I guess you'd think that when you're with the two models. And he says, no, no. And she says, what makes you an exception? And he thinks he's an exception. He was living with his eyes wide shut. And that's what freaks him out. She confesses an imagined and potential love affair, not a love affair, a sex affair, a moment of infidelity to prove that he's wrong in an argument. She tells him the whole story about the naval officer to prove that he's wrong. And then he thinks that gives him license now to go have a sexual adventure, but he never has one. And we could talk about that in a little bit, but I just think it's a great, disturbing, dead serious movie about what lurks underneath a seemingly, you know, a couple that has it all together. And that's my opening salvo about Eyes Wide Shut. What's yours?
Well, Here's the most generous reading I can give of the film. Like, if somebody actually asked me what it's about, this is all, it's almost too on the nose how much greenery is in the movie. In the first scene, Nicole Kidman, who's actually Tom Cruise's real life wife, she's on the toilet while he's brushing his teeth or finishing getting ready or whatever he's doing. And the two of them are together and they're naked, but they're not ashamed. And they're in their apartment full of greenery and they're in one unit together. And what happens is when they kind of go out amongst this garden that they're routinely in, and there's literally garlands and Christmas trees and everything everywhere, Nicole Kidman, the wife, encounters a snake. She runs into like a real life serpent in the shape of a person who tempts her. He says, "Do you want to have a sexual encounter with me?" And the answer that she gives is kind of no. But it's actually yes. And though they're dressed, you know, nobody, there's no kissing, there's no intimacy in the scene in the sense that we would think of it from a cinematic perspective, but it is in some sense the most sexual scene of the movie. It's intensely uncomfortably sexual between the two of them because it's very nakedly about desire, but not naked in a good way. And she allows herself to indulge, or she kind of bites of what he offers in her mind. And she does what happens in Genesis, which is she takes the thing that she's bitten and she gives it to her husband and he bites too. And all of a sudden they're naked together and they're ashamed and they can't go back to where they were. They can't go back to the first scene.
When he says to her, that's right, that's a very good reading of that scene, Mike, I think, because he says to her, she says, "I'm married," but she has all those little pauses there. And he says, "Oh, is it as bad as that?" She says, "As good as that." So her defense of her own marriage doesn't really sound wholehearted.
No, it sounds like it sounds like the flirtation scene from Romeo and Juliet when they meet each other at the ball.
Right.
And the final outcome of the scene is obvious to everybody by the flirtation that's going on in the scene. Again, that's a generous reading of the film. I think one interesting thing that Kubrick tries to do here is he tries to do with nudity what I think Tarantino tries to do with vulgarity and violence, which is, let me serve it to you every possible way until you can't even tell what it is. That when the model dies, mm-hmm. and he goes to check up on her at the hospital, they pull her naked body out of the drawer. And she's supposed to be a model, but she's also supposed to be dead. That's not eroticism.
This is the least erotic movie ever made. I mean, all the 15-year-old boys who went to see this movie thinking they'd see naked women, you see tons of naked women, but it might as well be reading Grey's Anatomy.
And I understand that. I understand that as the purpose of the film. I get it. There's nothing happening in this film where it's like, "Oh, Mike, you just don't know." I do get it. I get the moral implications. I get where the reading is coming from. I get the overall structure. I get the two-part detective story where that person now has to wander the fallen world because they've been kicked out of paradise and you can't find your way back.
So then why the hate? Why the hate?
Because it's a bad movie on every level. I'll say one more good thing and then I'm going to tell you a bunch of bad things.
Go.
What you said about Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise in the room together having an argument as husband and wife, that's true. They're great actors, both of them. Nicole Kidman, she's been on this podcast in a way before many times.
A friend of the pod.
And as you know, so I didn't finish the film the first time through. I watched the first hour plus tax and quit. And then I thought maybe I was just callow and naive the first time I watched it. So I tried it again for this podcast as an adult. And I almost quit in exactly the same spot because it's just not for me. But it's not necessarily for moral reasons. It's because everything that I love about movies in this movie is bad. And let me say one more thing, which is that we have different readings of greatness. I think you and I can agree on some great directors, great actors, great pictures, obviously, or this podcast wouldn't exist. But to me, there are no sacred cows. There's no such thing as Kubrick. There's no Kubrick umbrella. There's some of his films seem to share the same values and assumptions from an aesthetic perspective, but there's no such thing as Kubrick, just the same way that there's no such thing as John Ford. Some of his movies have things in common with one another, but they are not great because they're made by John Ford. John Ford is great because he made, overall, he did better than he did bad. And the same for Stanley Kubrick, who was a wonderful director, but there's no sacred cows.
Okay, fine. Yeah, there's no sacred cows. That's fine. Alfred Hitchcock has terrible movies too.
This movie is way too long. Structurally, it does not work. It's dialogue. And I get that its dialogue might be wooden on purpose. There is a thing going on, say, with it's very obvious that the dialogue in the space station in 2001 is meant to be weird.
Right.
It's very obvious that there's something that the hotel guys are not telling Jack Nicholson at the beginning of The Shining, and that's intended to be weird. I'm not out of the loop. I'm very much in the loop. The dialogue is terrible. Even the color saturation in this film is beautiful, but it's a little too choreographed. I understand that Kubrick was the kind of guy who choreographed everything. There's a scene where Tom Cruise knows he's being followed by the guy, mm-hmm. and he goes around the corner, and one car, and it's kind of a T-shaped intersection. They're yep. on the long piece of the T, and one car goes, and you know that there's a crew on the right hand going 3, 2, 1, okay, drive. And that driver probably did that 115 times. Like, we all know about his method and process. Nothing's by accident. But the background setting of this film in the fake village with all the Christmas lights, with the recreations, there's actually something almost like a little too twee or a little too cute that really makes me not even enjoy some of the color saturation in the film that you're supposed to enjoy. I think a Kubrickian thing that he does, Kubrick-esque, that I enjoy is when he goes to the prostitute's apartment in the village and he takes a very unbeautiful thing with very poor lighting. He uses some of the natural lighting in the apartment, which must have been a recreated studio, mm-hmm. but he makes some of the shots beautiful. That's a Kubrick thing, and I applaud him for that. That's pretty awesome because that's something that not a lot of people can do. But there's no aspect from its moral values, to its dialogue, to its performances, to its length, to its structure, to the way that it's shot, that makes this film good or up to Kubrick standard. And for that reason, like, I'm a hard pass.
Well, I think that people did complain when it was first out. And that, you know, a friend of mine said this movie should be called What I Remember About New York by Stanley Kubrick, because people complain about what New York looks like in this film. I think that's all done. And let me go back. First of all, it is long and I get it. So if somebody said, you know, I kind of like Eyes Wide Shut, but that's a slog of a movie, like, that wouldn't make me like jump out of my skin or jump up and down the way that people say 2001 is too long. Like, 2001 is not too long.
It's neither a second too long nor a second too short.
It's perfect, right? So, but if somebody said, oh, I think Eyes Wide Shut is too long, I'd be like, all right, fine. Yeah, you got to be in the mood for it. I don't think this movie's for everybody. But I think that the way that the city looks is meant to mirror what's going on in Tom Cruise, because the whole movie is, and it's not like an Owl Creek Bridge thing, like, was it all a dream? But it's dreamlike. It's about a guy in shock. It's about a guy wandering through New York the way that Leopold Bloom wanders through Dublin in Ulysses. This whole movie is like the Nighttown chapter of Ulysses. That's why everybody Tom Cruise meets either wants to have sex with him, is offering him sex, is offering him a way to have sex with somebody else. That's that in a quote unquote regular movie, that would be an eye roll and that'd be coincidence. But I think what happens is he's so freaked out by what his wife tells him that every single thing he looks at now is seen through that filter. That's why we get his quote unquote memory of his wife sleeping with a naval officer, which never happened, but that is actually all, it keeps coming in the movie. And you notice it gets more and more salacious and dirty as the movie goes on, because he can't shake it. And when you're holding a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
And it's black and white.
It's blue and white. It's blue and white.
Blue and white. Again, I get it. It's a little cute. And there's a lot of things about this movie that are a little cute. And it doesn't add up. It doesn't add up or match life in a way that I think that 2001 does. 2001 is a movie about things that never happened, but it seems much more real than Eyes Wide Shut, which I think, by the way, just to put this on record, is a film about things that I'm 100% sure happen. Like, I, you know, I'm like, this is not about me. This is not about trying to drag politics into it or saying like that stuff doesn't happen. Totally does happen. If you told me, hey, by the way, the most respectable looking people in society are the most open to the influence of Dionysus, and they get together for orgiastic revelry, I'd be like, yeah. What'd you pick up the paper today? Like,
yeah. Did you ever hear of Jeffrey Epstein? Right, exactly.
Right. So all of that is obvious. And I think the beauty of that is that it transcends the boundaries of politics. My point is that 2001 is very much less a fantasy film. There's nothing cute about it. It matches the experience of existence, and it has something for, it has something to be fed on. And the Eyes Wide Shut is a film very much about events that are hypothetically true, but they're true in like a,
but they're true to him. That's exactly the point. Her fantasy about the naval officer is hypothetically true, but she says it. She says it out loud. She says something you're never supposed to say out loud to the person you're married to, which is, I saw this other person, and the person almost, to be kind, I'll say, the person made me swoon. The person bowled me over. That is what you're not supposed to say. But she says it out loud, and that hypothetical becomes real for him. And I think that's a very human experience, that you don't want to know things about the person who's your soulmate.
And I'm not disagreeing or saying that that's a bad scene. I think that the way that it's unpacked is not a good movie. And again, you could tell me everything's on purpose. You can say the color saturation is on purpose. It's like, okay, it sucks. You could say the dialogue is written wooden, right? Everybody begins sentences with what phrase, Daniel?
To be perfectly honest with you.
Right, which could be an alternative title for the film. Do I think it's accidentally bad? No, I don't think it's accidentally bad.
I didn't notice that,
bad.
By the way. To our listeners, Mike started texting me the phrase, to be perfectly honest with you, over and over and over. And I'm like, what is he even talking about? Well, it turns out that Mike was annoyed because he said that comes up in the movie 100 times. I didn't notice that at all. I was into the movie. I didn't notice that tick of the screenplay at all.
And I get that that's likely on purpose. And it is also, again, it's a cute alternative title for the movie, right? Instead of Eyes Wide Shut. What happens is she is perfectly honest with him. And then he gets X-ray vision where he can see whether or not they're actually happening. He can see the hidden erotic and suggested undertones that underlie every conversation he has, every place he goes, and his society as a whole, your boss, your friend, the local judge, right? That's why everybody is cloaked and masked, because they want to conceal their identities. They want to keep themselves hidden. They don't want to be perfectly honest with you. And he's the only one at the party who is completely honest. He takes his hood and his mask off.
Let's talk about that in part two.
All right, we're sticking to the script here. It's part two, so we always talk about key scenes. So, Dan, what's a key scene?
I want to talk about how he starts to put on, you said, his night vision goggles or his 20/20 vision. After the argument gets out of control, he gets a phone call that one of his client dies, and he has to go over to the apartment where the old man is. So in true movie fashion, he puts a suit on again. He shakes off the pot high he's on and gets there, and he's talking about this woman's father, and she starts saying, you know, I love you, I love you. Remember, she leans over and kisses him. And that, the first time I saw it, I remember raising my eyebrows going like, what's going on? Because I think I didn't really know how to watch it. But I think that what happens is that's why this movie is so much like a dream, because everybody starts throwing themselves at him and they just start saying things. Like, even if she did love Tom Cruise, she wouldn't just start saying, I love you, I love you. I think that what that confession by his wife, I know I keep going back to that, is like pot. It's like a drug. And it heightens all his senses to the awareness where you start to see that everywhere. But I think that what's interesting about that scene is, you said this before about the prostitute that's up in Sidney Pollack's bathroom, which, by the way, is the most unbelievable bathroom like ever committed to film, is that woman leans over to Tom Cruise and starts kissing him while her father is dead on the bed next to her. And that sets up what I think is throughout this movie is the combination of sex and death. I mean, this is the least, there's no eroticism in the movie. It's sex and death are one inch away. What you said before about the morgue, what you said before about what he does with nudity, like Tarantino does with violence, right? I mean, and I think that sex without love, not to sound all moralistic here, but sex without love is a kind of death. And that's what I think the movie, that's what Tom Cruise can't articulate, and he can't put his finger on it because he tries really hard to go out and be Casanova for an evening. He wants to be James Boswell, but he can't do it. All his attempts are thwarted. But that's what I think is going on at the heart of this movie, especially in the last line, which we'll talk about later, that this movie is not, it's about the relationship with sex and death are so close. And that comes out the most in the orgy scene.
Look, I don't not buy that. You can't then build your entire film on the thing and not achieve emptiness. Meaning, I don't actually disagree with you that that's not.
You didn't feel
that is. No,
he starts crying at the end. He says, "I'll tell you everything."
No, I think the movie ultimately is extremely empty, and I think that the thing that it's, I think the conceit of the film is this. Doesn't work, meaning this emptiness, this sex, this hedonistic void doesn't work. However, that's what I'm going to build the house out of, and that's ultimately what's in it, and it's empty. Like I just see that as the central conceit of the movie. I think it's an interesting idea that failed, and it certainly does not make good viewing. I mean, this movie is like a carriage that doesn't have any wheels, but it's got two strong horses in front, and one is, you know, Tom Cruise and one is Nicole Kidman, and they're being controlled by Stanley Kubrick.
So what are the wheels?
Also master.
What are the wheels that are missing?
Strong dialogue, interesting structure, the kinds of things that his other movies have that keep people 2001 does not have good dialogue. But it has everything else firing.
It doesn't have dialogue on purpose,
right? But exactly. But so it's an omission. But it's a conscious omission which could have been filled in 2 seconds. It's the master who knows how to do it and is strong enough in their aesthetic purpose to leave that thing out because it's actually not needed. It's like, right. You know, asking why. So that's what it is. But this is a carriage with no wheels that's just being dragged along.
You didn't have any emotional reaction to anything. So for example, did you think the orgy scene was scary? Did you think it was disturbing? I sure did.
Of course it's scary and it's disturbing, but that's not emotional content in the same way. And I think that what's partially missing in this film is, I'll give you an example. In The Shining, one of the things that makes The Shining work is you have a character who's crazy or possessed, right? And then you have some kind of normative function from other characters who are talking and speaking and acting normally. Mm-hmm. And so they're giving them a backdrop against which they can move. One of the things that's structurally missing from this film is it's everybody. Everybody's in on it. Everybody's doing it. And I understand that as a conceit, but it does not work as a film. Everybody rolls their eyes at these tropes, like when you have a Frodo character in a world building type of scheme. And it's like, why do I need you need somebody who has a little bit of information, but is picking up information so that I can pick up information so that I can be comfortable. And that comfort is not something that you can just casually discard aesthetically and still make your structure work. Unless you have an absolutely tour de force, once in a lifetime idea of something that you're going to pull off, right? If you're going to, E.B. White says, if you're going to be a genius, like just go be one, which is fine. But this movie was maybe made by a genius, but it is not a work of genius. It breaks a lot of the rules and it does not break them successfully. It breaks them, and those breakages are certainly felt by this viewer.
Everybody is not in on it. Everybody in the movie is not in on it. Tom Cruise isn't in on it. That's what the movie's about.
No, he isn't. He is in on it.
How is he? He's not. He's the babe in the woods. That's why he breaks down at the end. We'll talk about that in part 3. But I mean, he's the babe in the woods. He tries to be a Boy Scout. That's why he can't.
I understand that he is a naive, but it doesn't work. It doesn't work in the same way So you may come back at me and you may say, okay, well, this movie has the structure of Alice in Wonderland. What about Alice in Wonderland? Why does Alice work and this doesn't? Because there's something about the actual innocence of Alice that makes it work, which in Tom Cruise's character is totally subverted, right? He gets to the party by his own curiosity, not because he's trapped and trying to go home.
Right.
And
that's true.
Right. And so you may say to me, but Michael, what does that have to do with the movie? And what it has to do with the movie is that if you lack anything else, but you give strong motivation, you give strong ulterior motivation that makes the plot work, right? It's not just something that you do for the audience. There are rules to art. It's a science as much as it is anything else. And you can't break them all and still expect your thing to work because it doesn't.
I think dreams don't work that way. I think great dreams don't work that way. You have watched Bugs Bunny your whole life, and so have I. You ever see the one, wait a minute, you ever see the one where the bank robber, I think, is going like, everyone's turned into rabbits. And then Bugs Bunny turns around and thinks he's like, what's all this with rabbits, Doc? That's what this movie is. Everybody's turning into rabbits, and that's a nightmare. Now, so it doesn't obey the rules. And I understand everything what you're saying. I'm not, you know, but
I'm with Dreamstruck. But we've done movies on the podcast that have dream structures or have intuitive structures. How do they work? Do you remember when we did The Lighthouse?
Sure.
Right. The Lighthouse runs on a nightmarish intuitive structure that shouldn't work. So what makes it work? Right. It obeys at least a couple of the classical unities. The two of them are trapped and they can't get out. It doesn't work if they could just leave.
But there's no normal person in the White House like to bounce off either of their weirdness.
I'm not arguing for one rule over the other. I'm saying you have to pick, even if you just pick one, they are rules for a reason. And I'm not angry at Kubrick for not following the rules. I'm upset that I sat through this empty movie and then we're going to, you know, and then we have an episode called Eyes Wide Shut and people are like, I guess Mike and Dan both like it. No, I do not. It does not work as a film. And I don't care who made it. I don't care if my brother made it or Stanley Kubrick made it. It doesn't work. Right. So The Lighthouse at least observes some of the classical unities and then it does whatever it wants. But you at least have a base structure. They're trapped in there. They can't get out. The dialogue is compelling. You're not sure where you are the entire time. Right. Nobody was born and raised in that lighthouse. I really do. I didn't know what you said about Kubrick in New York until you brought it up on the podcast. And I understand if he has a personal fuzzy nostalgia for what's being portrayed. And I can appreciate that, but I don't care as a viewer.
All right, we're going to wind this thing down because we're never going to see eye to eye on this, but that's fine. You know, having a 99.4% average is pretty darn good. I'll just say this. We can go back and forth and nothing I say will convince you. Nothing you say will convince me. But again, I am not going to die on the Eyes Wide Shut hill. I don't think that's what it's for. But I do think it's interesting. And I do think it's never boring. Now you think it's terribly boring.
I do think it's boring.
Yeah. I don't think it's ever boring. I think it's filled with dread. And I think that dread is both physical, like he's in physical danger because they give him the note and they say, and then when they put the mask on the pillow, like they're definitely onto him. But I think the dread is also about how he's supposed to go back. And we always talk about the end of the title in our last segment. That's what goes on in the toy store, I think, at the end. So at the very end, they're kind of reconciling in the toy store. They're going to buy their kid a Christmas present or whatever they're going to buy her. And she says, okay, we're awake now. And he says, forever. He's going to go back. And she has that thing. No, don't say forever. I can't deal with forever. Let's not use that word. It frightens me. And she says, I do love you. And she says, there's something very important we need to do as soon as possible. And he says, what's that? And she says, she drops the F-bomb, which is interesting, the last word of the last movie of Stanley Kubrick. Now, of course, that word does not mean what Bill is thinking. He wants her to say, we should make love, but she doesn't. And I think that before you said, I forgot, you said something earlier about the way the movie presents the emptiness of the world. This movie takes her side at the end. It's like the Grateful Dead song, the women are smarter. It kind of takes her side at the end. He's the naive, like you said, he's the Boy Scout. So when she says that at the end and then the credits come on, you know, I think it's a very cold, cold movie. And he's never getting back. That marriage is never getting back together. They have to go through it in this dreamlike thing with their eyes wide shut. What did Ben Franklin say? He has that line. He said, before you got married, go into every marriage with both of your eyes open. And then once you're married with, you know, with both of them half closed. And I think that's kind of what happens at the end of the movie.
I don't disagree with what you just said. I think that, again, you have to do certain structural things.
You just think it doesn't work.
It does. But it really doesn't. And I'm trying to get us, because I know that you know what works. I know that you know what works, right? But you don't counterbalance something that doesn't weigh anything on the other side, right? It's irony for its own sake. At whose expense even is that joke, right? Alice in Wonderland.
It's at his expense.
Well, it's at my expense. It's at my expense. But it's obviously untrue, because it does not match. Some of its tensions match lived experiences.
Yes.
Some of its anxieties match lived experience. Again, not, you know, in a contemporary political element, some of its sensationalism match lived experience, but its lived experience is not lived experience.
It doesn't match my lived experience.
Correct.
Thank God. Right. But like, you know, the Seven Samurai doesn't match my lived experience either.
Yes, it does, because that's like fault. If you took Falstaff's, what is honor, right? It is a word. You know, who had it?
Him that died yesterday.
Him that died a Wednesday, right? And if you took that and you interpreted that through the eyes of a specific culture at a specific time, and you played with the idea, you would get the Seven Samurai. And that's what makes even certain speeches just inside Shakespeare work as little poems or little encapsulated moments. This movie is not, it's not punching up or down or sideways. It's shadow boxing. Like, it's not actually even punching anything.
So you think it's what Gertrude Stein said about, she said it about California. There's no there. There's no there there. Right. But I think it's not lived experience, but it gives you a window into the humanity of some people and what some people go through. This movie is not a mirror. Thank God. This movie for me is more of a window. Sometimes movies can be windows or mirrors. This is a window, because think about this. How does Full Metal Jacket end? You remember how Full Metal Jacket ends? They're singing the Mickey Mouse song, right? And then Joker says, I am in a world of shit, but at least I'm alive. And then the credits. Well, that's only one small. You said before that Eyes Wide Shut doesn't tell the whole story.
I didn't say everything has to have a positive experience.
No, it doesn't show the whole story of humanity. You said Nicole Kidman's thing was not the whole story of marriage. She's obviously, but it's a sliver of it. It just says the movie doesn't encompass all of human feeling and all of marriage.
Nor do I expect it to. But it does not follow. It does not follow any aesthetic rules or principles. And I understand how some people would take that and consider it a badge of honor. But if you only follow one or two, it is. But if you follow none of them, it's not. It's just terrible.
I don't take it as a badge of honor. That's not why I thought it was interesting.
It's a poor film. It's the first or second draft of a script that got made by a person who has one of the best and most natural eyes that ever lived. And I'm have no problem admitting that about Kubrick. And he had two of the greatest workhorses in Hollywood at the time, who were, by the way, actually married with it, right, which should be an extra element of interest. But I think that the most interesting thing about this movie is that it's in the Guinness Book of World Records for how long it took to film. That's the most interesting thing about it. It has nothing to recommend it. And again, you can have a structure in which a naive wanders through a nightmare world, but then you have to obey the structures. Even Alice in Wonderland obeys the structures. The Wizard of Oz obeys the structures. That is a literary structure, and it works, and it has rules. This does not follow any of those rules. It doesn't even understand those rules, and it doesn't think about itself in those terms.
Well, I think it does work. I think that it does work, and that's why the movie is so unsettling. Almost as unsettling as this episode of 50 Minute Film Fanatics. Thanks for listening, everybody. We hope you enjoyed our debate about Eyes Wide Shut. You can follow us on X at 15minfilm. You can also follow us where, Mike?
Letterboxd.
Now, remember, we agree about almost all of these, but if you think there's another movie that you'd like to get our hot take on, please give us a suggestion. Please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, or you could email us. The email address is on our X account. We hope we get some recommendations from you soon. Thank you.
Watch something else.
I also actually just thought of something else before we actually leave. I just want to go also bring up the point that you thought The Omen was a good movie. And but this is not
the Omen. The
no,
Omen.
You actually thought it was bad. You thought it was bad, but wonderfully
it is bad. It is bad. It's awesomely bad because it's unironically bad. It's encapsulated in its own self-congratulation in a way that makes it endearing. Right? This movie pretends to be superior. It tells you that it has something to say and it does not have anything to say. It's the world is cheap and it is cheap. And now I have no problem admitting that you could, again, it's not a moralistic argument. You could take the same things that happen in the film, like if you storyboarded them all out, and you could make a good movie based on that. If somebody took the source material and readapted it into something else, I might actually watch that to see how it differs from Eyes Wide Shut. But this is sloppy, and it's sloppy work from somebody I don't expect sloppy work from. So it's doubly startling.
All right, well, let me know how you think of Omen 2. Maybe Omen 2 will be as good as Eyes Wide Shut.